You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Grave. Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Grave. I'm your host today. At Food Integrity Now, we envision a world without GMOs, a thriving world where our food is safe for our children and our grandchildren. If you share this vision, go to our website and join us. If you're interested in advertising with us, whether you have a small business or a large business, we have several different options available. Just send us an email to ads@foodintegritynow.org. Our show today is brought to you by Biolumina and Wild Dolphin Swim Adventures. Hi, it's Carol again, and I wanted to tell you about a product that I use and I highly endorse. Spirulina is called a superfood because its nutrient content is more potent than any other food. Biolumina is the premium spirulina. It's grown cleanly without any synthetics, GMOs, or pesticides. Biolumina is a proven immune booster and contains a powerful antioxidant called phycocyanin. I've been taking this product for over a year now, and I feel like it's one of the finest whole food supplements on the market. To find out more about Biolumina, go to newphoenixrising.com/beingwell. Once again, that's newphoenixrising.com/beingwell. You're going to love this product. I'm Carol Grave, and I'm one of the hosts of Food Integrity Now and a certified life coach, and I'd love to share an amazing adventure with you. Have you ever dreamed of swimming with the wild dolphins? I'm not talking about the ones in captivity at Dolphin Quest. I'm talking about swimming with them in the wild. I invite you to join me for a trip of a lifetime to swim with the dolphins. To find out more, go to wilddolphinswimadventures.com or email carol@coachwithcarol.com. I'm really excited about our show today. I have two wonderful guests. I have Sally Fallon Merrill today, and I also have Sandrine Love. Sally Fallon Merrill is a journalist, chef, nutritional researcher, homemaker, and community activist. She is also the president and treasurer of the Weston A. Price Foundation. She is the author of Nourishing Traditions, the cookbook that challenges politically correct nutrition. This well-researched, thought-provoking guide of traditional food contains a startling message. Animal fats and cholesterol are not villains, but vital factors in the diet. Sandrine Love is an award-winning activist. She previously worked as a marriage and family therapist, art therapist, teacher, and as a learning specialist in a private practice before establishing Nourishing Our Children in 2005. She was convinced that the children that she worked with were not well-fed, but malnourished. So Sandrine closed her private practice to devote herself to the cause of educating and inspiring parents to return to the whole natural foods that have produced generation after generation of healthy children. She is also the founder of the San Francisco chapter of the Weston A. Price Foundation, which she established in 2004. Sally and Sandrine, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm so excited to have both of you on the show today, and I thought we would start out with just a little bit of history, a brief overview of the Weston A. Price Foundation, you know, when it was founded, and maybe just a few of the underlying principles of the foundation.
Is that a segue to me there?
That's a segue to you, Sally. Okay.
All right, well, the Weston A. Price Foundation was founded to provide accurate information about nutrition, especially as it applies to children, to creating the healthiest generation of children we can. And it's based on the work of Weston Price, who was a dentist who traveled all over the world studying healthy traditional peoples. Our emphasis is on the foods that supply what we call the fat-soluble activators, the fat-soluble vitamins, the very foods we're being told not to eat today. Foods like butter, egg yolks, meat fats, and organ meats, and certain seafoods. So we have a very different message, but we are definitely have become a force to be reckoned with. We're over 16,000 members now with since 1999 when we were founded.
Wonderful. And Sandrine, and so you founded a chapter of the Weston A. Price Foundation in San Francisco. Is that correct?
Correct. So in 2004, I appeared on Dr. Thomas Cowan's doorstep, so to speak, suffering from insomnia. And I left with the book Nourishing Traditions in my hand and my life forever changed. Because there was no chapter in San Francisco, even though I really wasn't in a position to lead the community, I decided to establish a chapter just so that those who were already members, you know, had a sort of forum by which to meet. And I established a Yahoo group. And sure enough, within a few months, we were, you know, supporting each other in integrating these principles. And at the one-year mark of having established the chapter, we were at 400 members and we're spending a lot of time enjoying potlucks and farm tours amongst ourselves. And I, at the time, was working as a learning specialist in private practice and really started to formalize in my mind this notion that the kids in my practice were not necessarily learning disabled, but rather malnourished. And I wanted an educational tool to teach the parents about these principles. And all we had at that time was Sally's six-hour all-day seminar on traditional diets. And I wanted something sort of succinct and, you know, manageable for any presenter to give. So we launched Nourishing Our Children as an educational initiative, originally just to educate the local community. And then as a result of that educational initiative becoming so popular, I resigned my chapter leadership and focused exclusively there on that message. And it's become a educational tool that others are using in their communities.
Wonderful. Well, from there, let's talk about the new book, The Nourishing Traditions, Book of Baby and Child Care. And by the way, I don't have little babies, but I just find this book fascinating. And I want to give it to everybody I know that is thinking about going to have a baby or has young children. So, Sally, this book really, really covers everything. I had no idea how comprehensive it was going to be. But it, you know, it covers everything from preconception through preparing for fetal development, nourishing your baby, all the way to the remedies for illnesses for children. So let's start with preparing for your baby. What are some of the key steps that you feel are important, some of the steps that's covered in the book?
Yes, this is absolutely the number one focus of the Nourishing Traditions book of baby and child care. And it's a focus that we are not seeing in modern society. About the only advice mothers might get when they say they want to have a baby is, well, start taking your prenatal vitamin. And traditional cultures put a tremendous emphasis on special feeding starting at least 6 months before conception for both the father and the mother. And the foods that were considered important are the very foods that mothers are told not to eat, the high cholesterol, high fat animal foods that we pretty much shun as a culture. So I spend a lot of time talking about these foods and why they are important. And we actually have a diet for preconception, pregnant women and nursing mothers. And it includes butter every day, 2 egg yolks a day, liver 2 or 3 times a week, and a quart of whole raw milk every day. And this may surprise a lot of people, but you know, we've had now about 10 years of babies being born with mothers following this diet. And I can tell you these babies are absolutely beautiful. And they have such lovely personalities. They don't cry much. They sleep early, you know, they sleep through the night early, They're not fussy. They grow and meet their milestones as they're supposed to.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned was the raw milk. And I know for a lot of people, it's not really easy to get raw milk. I know in Colorado, it's illegal to sell it in certain places. So you have to buy a share of a dairy cow. What do you have any comments about that and what people can do?
Yeah, well, two things. I believe this is one of the reasons it took me so long to write this book. I'd hoped to have it finished 7 or 8 years ago, and it took me much longer. And during that time, raw milk has become so much more available. So much more available. And we tell people how to find it, how to get it. And I even suggest, you know, moving somewhere else if you can, to so you can be near and have easy access to raw milk, because it's a real insurance policy, not only for the mother when she's pregnant, but for the child when he's growing. It is, you know, really does ensure that you're going to have optimal development of the child. There are things you can do if you can't get raw milk. You can always get raw cheese, which is a wonderful food. And you can always make bone broth. And those are the two things that would substitute for it. What will be difficult, or would be difficult, if you are having trouble breastfeeding, is the raw milk formula. You definitely need raw milk for that.
Okay. And that formula is in the book as well, too, the raw milk formula.
Yes.
Okay. So I love that you started out with, you know, preparing for the baby, and you included, you know, the father too, which I think that is so often omitted, you know, from the picture.
We know this is totally based on science. The quality of the sperm at the time of conception is very much dependent on the father's diet, but you know, this needs to be a journey that father and mother take together. And if one or the other of the prospective parents is not willing to do this diet, which is a diet that the family needs to follow forever, you know, while they're bringing up the children, then it's better to find that out before conception than after, because there could be some real family problems and differences over the diet if the two parents are not on the same page.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that whole cholesterol issue, you know, Sally, you've been on my show before, and do you remember our vegan conversation?
I've been on a lot of shows, so.
Well, for a brief period of time in my life, I was a vegan, and that didn't work for me. And you really assisted me with that.
Oh, good.
And one of the reasons that I said, you know, I was going to do this, you know, that I had had typical high cholesterol, and I was a healthy person. You know, I considered myself, I eat well, I exercise, and yet I had high cholesterol. And do you want to talk a little bit about cholesterol?
Well, first of all, for women, there's no such thing as high cholesterol. There's no greater risk of heart disease at any level of cholesterol for women, even if it's up in the thousands. But the tragedy of making a villain out of cholesterol has hit our children. Our children are paying the price for this misinformation, because cholesterol is absolutely critical for forming the baby, for the production of hormones, for the development of the baby's brain and nervous system, and most critically for development of the gut, and to get the good, tight, non-leaky gut, you need plenty of cholesterol. And what are we seeing in our children today? An epidemic of digestive disorders, leaky gut syndrome, allergies, and along with that goes the behavior problems and the learning difficulties.
Yeah. Well, oh, yes, go ahead, Sandrine.
I just want to interject a question, because since Nourishing Our Children has a very large Facebook presence, we've just passed 20,000 followers, so to speak, a lot of questions come up, and I think this is an opportunity for me to kind of relay some questions related to cholesterol just came up. Sally mentioned that there is no number that could be considered too high.
For women.
Okay,
yes.
So I remember that in our presentation that we give based on your work, you mentioned that a pregnant woman in China will eat up to 10 eggs a day if she can't afford them.
Yes.
And a nutritionist even within our community suggested to me, who eats eggs very regularly, that the consumption of eggs should be limited, and eating two or three a day would be considered prohibitive. And I just want to speak to that because I had remembered you mentioning that they would eat up to 10 eggs a day. There's still a persistent fear of eggs.
Oh, I know. And you know, even the most ardent proponents of the cholesterol theory, and I'm thinking of Ansel Keys, was very emphatic that the diet did not influence cholesterol levels. And that's why they started pushing the drugs, because they couldn't bring cholesterol levels down in a consistent way by changing the diet. And there have been a number of studies exonerating eggs, including a study about a man who ate 50 eggs a day and he had normal cholesterol. So we are demonizing one of the most nutritious foods. Now, I will say this, that the egg white is for some people very difficult to digest. It is for me, and I have to be careful with the egg whites. So if that's your case, then you would just go with the yolks and have them in smoothies or make custards and things like that with the yolks.
And may I just ask you, Sally, for those who always mm-hmm. want a reference, where are you getting the information that there is no cholesterol level that is too high for women?
The reference, I don't remember it off the top of my head, but it's on our website. It was in Dr. Raffenskopf's book. It came out of a consensus conference held at NIH, and it was then corroborated by a couple more studies.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm so excited to have clarity on that. I didn't mean to hijack the show, Carol.
No, you're not. I appreciate your interjection. That's why I wanted to have both of you on the show with me today. So that's wonderful. The book starts out in preparing for the baby, the preconception, and then you move on to nutrition for fetal development. And what I really like is how it's broken down into trimesters, and then you go into the importance of different vitamins and nutrients. Can you expand a little bit on that for our listeners?
Well, I think the most important thing to understand, especially in that first trimester when the organs are being formed, is the predominance of need for vitamin A. Because vitamin A is the concert master of fetal development. It is vitamin A that gives the stem cells their signals to become heart cells or kidney cells or brain cells or whatever. And if there's not enough vitamin A when you become pregnant, that process will start out without adequate vitamin A, and things can go wrong. And this just underscores the need to build up our stores of vitamin A before pregnancy and then continue with these vitamin A-rich foods. Absolutely critical during the first trimester, but it's important all the way along. I mean, for example, we have research showing that the number of kidney cells that a child ends up with is largely dependent on vitamin A status in the last trimester. So these nutrient-dense foods like egg yolks and liver and fish eggs and all the kinds of foods we're talking about are really, really critical for this process. Now, we also go into there are many, many other nutrients that are critical for this process. And one of them, for example, is glycine, which we get from bone broth. So I just go through those one by one in that chapter.
Yes. And can you speak a little bit about cod liver oil?
Oh, yes. We're very big on cod liver oil for providing a nice balance of vitamins A and D, the two critical nutrients for fetal development. And we urge mothers to get used to taking it before they get pregnant, build up their stores. You do this all through pregnancy. You do it through nursing. You start cod liver oil with your baby when he's a few months old, and then get that child used to getting his cod liver oil every day. My own grandson gets his cod liver oil with a little syringe that comes with the cod liver oil. And he just loves his cod liver oil. He actually grabs a syringe and wants to lick it afterwards.
Wow.
And I want to just interject that we recently posted several videos that mothers have taken of the children begging for more, that there's a conflict between the parents. You know how parents, you know, that's enough, and they're wanting more and crying and having an upset because the parents won't give them more and more cod liver oil. So there's this myth that children don't like cod liver oil. They won't take it. You have to bribe them. You know.
And if you start young enough, yes.
Yeah, you have to start young, because I will tell you, I've taken cod liver oil, and I'm going to start taking it again after reading the book. Mm-hmm. But I remember when I was taking it, I had to get the lemon flavor, and, you know, I kept it in the refrigerator, and it was not – I didn't really love it.
Well, the key thing for adults is don't try to take it on a spoon. It's not so much the taste, but the oily – you know, the oily consistency. What I do, I put mine in a little shot glass, and I add pretty hot water, but still warm, you know, not so hot I can't drink it. I stir that round, and I just gulp it down, bypass the taste buds.
Okay.
And I'm a pretty sensitive, picky eater. There's a lot of things that I have a hard time eating, but I don't have any problem taking cod liver oil.
Well, does it come in any other does it come any other way other than?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes. You can get different flavors and capsules, but the capsules are more expensive than getting the liquid.
But you still get the same benefits, so people can. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so let's move on to pregnancy. You talk a lot about the prenatal vitamins that typically, you know, the doctors just automatically prescribe. And I'd like you to expand a little bit about what's in those vitamins. And then after that, we'll talk a little bit about saturated fat and then weight gain.
Okay, so I don't recommend prenatal vitamins, although I do, if someone really is insistent, I do provide what I would consider the best choice. Which is actually not designed to be prenatal, but I have a lot of problems with them. These are all synthetic vitamins. They're made in big factories. By the way, most of these vitamins, almost 100% of them, are made in China, where there's no oversight on how they're made. The vitamin A in these formulas is carotenes, which you can actually overdose on carotenes and interfere with the true vitamin A. So there's just lots of problems with the prenatals, and I have a list of all, you know, the nutrients you need and how to get them from food.
Okay, great.
Now I just want to say that quite a few people have sent me vitamins that are considered whole food based, mm-hmm. and they really, you know, they really don't feel comfortable with the notion of having a pregnancy without those vitamins, because it's been so instilled as a recommendation, a widespread recommendation. So what I'm hearing you say, Sally, is there really isn't those whole food-based vitamins, you're saying really aren't?
Well, you know, I can't say for each one because I haven't looked at them, but I do give one example in the book of a whole foods-based vitamin. Oh. If someone wants to take a vitamin, I recommend Dr. Ron's vitamin without A and D, the multivitamin without A and D, and then you take the multivitamin with cod liver oil. So you're actually getting your cod liver oil from a food and not the synthetic versions.
Great. And also I know that a concern for me about taking vitamins is there's so many vitamins that are genetically modified too.
Yes. This is something I didn't know when I wrote the book, but I just learned they use genetically modified organisms to produce these vitamins through a fermentation process.
Right. And for our listeners, you can just do your research online to find out which vitamins are not genetically modified. And I feel that's just an important thing to bring up. So let's talk about saturated fats.
Well, I do have quite a bit about saturated fat in there. There's, you know, pregnant women are told not to eat saturated fat, and there really is no evidence, or certainly the evidence is very conflicting. And the saturated fats are just so important for your baby to have healthy cells. The saturated fats support hormone production. They are highly protective against infection, and they support your immune system. So you want to continue with those saturated fats while you're pregnant.
Great. And then you also talk a little bit about weight gain and give some guidelines. And it's, you know, the weight gain thing is, it seems like it's so individual.
Yes, my advice is, you know, if you're going over the number they tell you, I wouldn't worry about it too much. I think it's more important to gain a little extra weight than not to gain enough weight. But if you are gaining weight, then just cut back on the carbohydrates and focus more on the fats and the proteins.
Right.
Sally, this brings a question up that came up this week amongst our readers. A woman wondered when it was okay to start dieting. And she was at the 6-month mark. She was still breastfeeding and wondered if it was okay to start dieting. And we collectively advised her not to, because she was still breastfeeding. Yeah. But what do you advise a woman who's really wanting to lose some weight, but it's not coming off just through breastfeeding alone?
Well, I think she could diet in the sense of cutting back on carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. She could definitely do that, but I wouldn't cut back on any of the very nutrient dense foods for sure.
And what about smaller portions? What do you think?
Yeah, smaller portions, but you need to be very careful in what you actually choose to eat now at mm-hmm. this point. You know, that's interesting to me because my own experience with breastfeeding was I'd never been so thin in my life as when I was breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. That it's a great way to lose weight.
Yeah, I had that. I had the same experience. I remember. I mean, this sounds tacky, but I'll just say it. I remember I had big boobs and I was thin.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to worry about my weight at all. But then again, my kids are in their 30s. So when I was breastfeeding, you know, I was hearing things like, you know, make sure you drink a couple of beers a day, you know, cause that makes good breast milk. And it's basically grew up with the Dr. Spock type mentality that I think so many of us did.
You know, Carol, one thing I want to say about the pregnancy, and it's a very, I spent a lot of time on it in the book, is the dangers of ultrasound.
And, oh, okay. Wonderful.
I have a whole page of studies indicating that the ultrasound is associated with more left-handedness, delayed speech, delayed development. And I'm very concerned about the use of ultrasound. Now, I don't mean going in once or twice to find out if your baby's normal and if you want to find out what sex it is. But there are women who are getting ultrasounds every week. And the other thing that people don't realize is that the fetal monitor that the doctors use just to listen to the heartbeat, that's ultrasound also. So it's very much to be avoided. You know, don't do it routinely and find a doctor who'll use a fetoscope, which is a stethoscope for listening to the baby. And avoidance of ultrasound is one of the main reasons you want to have a natural childbirth, because if you're, you know, having a difficult birth, if you're getting a cesarean, they have that ultrasound machine on the whole time. And one study described the effect of the noise from the ultrasound on the fetus as being like, sounding like a train coming into a station. Mm. They're very loud. They heat up the cells, and that deactivates enzymes that the baby's using for growth.
Right. Something you said brought up a question in my mind was about natural childbirth. And it seems to me that many of the doctors, not all, many of the doctors are scheduling cesareans because it fits their schedule.
That's right. That's right.
And,
you know, yeah, I don't want to be too critical of women who have cesareans because the cesarean is a lifesaver.
Yes.
And a lot of these mothers would not make it. I mean, we don't have this era when childbirth was a life-threatening condition. And that's largely thanks to cesareans. Now, it's not ideal, but we need to be realistic about, you know, women don't go having babies in fear of their lives anymore.
Well, you know, I want to mention that many women report in our community that they couldn't. Their pelvic, width, they had evidence of what Weston Price would call physical degeneration there. They just couldn't physically have an natural childbirth, have a vaginal birth, because they had such a narrow passage.
Yes, that's right. So at the same time, I mean, a natural birth is greatly to be wished for. And I do have a little sidebar in the book about all of the hormones that are involved in widening the pelvis and getting the contractions going and so forth. And once again, they're very much dependent on these fat-soluble vitamins, especially A and D. So there's the good nutrition right through pregnancy will also support quick and easy birth.
Wonderful. Okay, so let's move on to when the baby is born, and you talk about when to introduce certain foods, and you know, of course, breastfeeding is best, but you also have in there a formula, which you know, is raw milk based, correct?
Right. And I've come under a lot of criticism by you know, breastfeeding advocates saying that I'm against breastfeeding. And I'm not against breastfeeding, but I'm also a realist that it doesn't always work. And it's not just because you have some kind of bad technique. It's because you truly don't have enough milk. And finally, a lot of doctors and even breastfeeding advocates have had to admit that this is the case. The estimates are from 10 to 15% of women just don't have enough milk. And why would it be otherwise? This is true in the animal world. Listen, I have dairy cows, and some dairy cows give 4 gallons a day, and some dairy cows give half a gallon a day. So why wouldn't it be the same with mothers? And these mothers need a good nutritious formula that's something other than commercial formula, which has got to be the quintessential imitation food. So this raw milk formula is based on raw milk, but it has a number of things added to it or done to it to make it more in line with the profile of mother's milk. And as Sandrine can tell you, this formula has been life-saving. It has it's just been uniformly successful. I won't say we haven't had few cases in severe milk allergy where the child had to do our other formula, which was a liver-based formula. But overall, these formulas have just been extremely successful. Isn't that what you hear, Sandrine?
Yes, we hear we hear both two things. Those who have used the formula praise it and recommend it without hesitation as, like you said, a lifesaver. Those who haven't used the formula are critical. They think that somehow it's an easy option, that mothers aren't supported enough in breastfeeding, that they with enough support they could produce more milk, or there's, you know, maybe some issue that has yet to be uncovered about why the you know, breastfeeding isn't successful. And
You know what, I'm going to interrupt you, and that may very well be true. There may be things that you can do, but you don't have a lot of time. When your baby is starving and not growing and failing to thrive, you don't have a lot of time to figure this all out. And I can tell you from personal experience, when you give that baby the first bottle with the raw milk formula and see how beautifully they react to it, you know you're doing the right thing.
Right. Well, one of the complaints, so to speak, that I hear is that the Weston A. Price Foundation and you specifically, Sally, don't advocate more for donor milk. And, you know, we've talked in the community about the fact that many sort of formal donor milk banks are pasteurized. The milk is pasteurized.
Yes.
You
yes.
don't know the source. You don't know what the mother's diet is. So you don't really know the quality of the milk. If one has access to someone in their community whom they know is eating a nutrient-dense diet, or, you know, a mother would feel confident supplying that breast milk, that's something that people would like to see advocated more. And I think the only reason you haven't is because the mainstream options are questionable.
Well, I do have something in the book about donor milk and what to look for and, you know, how to find it. So it's all there, but I think it's a little bit unrealistic to think that all of these mothers who can't nurse are going to be able to find donor milk.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of milk.
That's a lot of milk and a lot of contacts that have to be made. And once again, I need to stress this point. You don't have a lot of time. You really don't have a lot of time to figure out what you're going to do if your baby is not thriving on what you can produce.
Well, one argument that we hear that Sally and I have spoken about recently is that even the worst quality breast milk, people will assert, is still better than any formula, commercial, homemade, or otherwise. So there are those advocates that really just think that somehow they've been told, and Sally quotes it in her book in the introduction, actually, from the La Leche League. You know, the quote is, your milk has every vitamin, mineral, and other nutritional element that your baby's body needs. There's no need to worry about the quality of your milk. Eating more won't make more milk, and not eating enough won't make less milk.
And so, I spent a lot of time in the book with studies, scientific studies with references, showing the great disparity you can have in nutrients in the milk depending on the diet. One thing I will say about this book that I am proud of, I think it's probably the most scientifically based book on babies out there. You know, there are pages and pages of references. And that's not something you find in most books on bringing up babies.
Yes, I noticed that too. That's wonderful. So back to the breastfeeding issue just for a few more minutes. You talk in the book about soy. Why is soy so toxic?
Well, soy is toxic for a number of reasons. It's a goitrogen that causes thyroid problems. But when we're talking about the development of the child, it is an endocrine disruptor. And even a very small amount of soy in the mother's diet, these endocrine disruptors can pass through the placenta and cause changes in the baby. What the animal studies show is you get much more anxious animals, anxious rats, if they're exposed to these estrogens in the womb and they don't have the normal behavior patterns. So it's very much to be avoided. And, of course, the soy infant formula is like a kiss of death. It is just loads the child with these endocrine disruptors very early in life. It's also very hard on the digestive system. There is no greater example, in my opinion, of how wrong that we have gone as a society if we think it's okay to give soy formula to our babies.
Well, and another thing about soy, as we know, most of it's genetically modified too.
Well, you know, I really don't think that's the issue. I mean, all of this research showing that the soy is bad, 95% of it was done with regular soy.
Mm.
If anything, the genetically modified soy is worse, but it's like the worst of the worst. You know?
Right, right. So maybe not relevant in this case. Okay.
But I do have a strong warning against genetically modified foods of any kind. Corn, soy, canola, whatever.
Yeah.
A little bit further on in the book, but you don't want to be giving these foods to your baby. In the animal studies, what they most of all indicate is digestive problems.
Right. And I know too, because I've done a lot of research and speak a lot on genetically modified ingredients, and it's just, you know, you and I didn't grow up eating genetically modified foods like the children of today. And
yes.
So their immune systems can be compromised at a very young age, whereas, you know, many of us, not all of us, but many of us grew up with a little bit of a healthier start than that. So
the genetically modified foods in the animal studies were particularly dangerous for growing animals. So you want to keep them out of your child's diet for sure.
Yes, exactly. So let's talk about this controversial subject, vaccinations.
The vaccination chapter in the book is very strong. We come at it from several angles. The bottom line is we're squarely against vaccinations. It is not the right way to protect your child. And I like Dr. Cowan's explanation the most. What the vaccinations do is stimulate what's called the humoral immune system, and not the cell-mediated immune system. I don't want to get too technical. But what this leads to is autoimmune diseases, the immune system reacting too strongly and then attacking your own body. I also list numerous studies showing that children who are vaccinated, just they get sick more often. They have more asthma. They have all more of everything. And whereas the children who are not vaccinated, who develop their own immune systems in contact with the world the way it's supposed to be, just are healthier all the way around.
Right. And you break.
That doesn't even count for the rare but extremely tragic acute reactions to vaccinations, which lead to seizures and autism and so forth.
Well, you break this down, which I think is wonderful in the book, into the three categories, the broad categories, you know, that being, do they work?
Yes.
And then there's the issue of the toxicity of the vaccine components.
Yes.
And then prevent predictable medical problems independent of the toxicity issues?
Yes, right.
So
I just wanted to mention that we had a guest blogger this week post for us for the Nourishing Our Children community about whooping cough, as it's commonly known, the vaccine against that. And so I did a questionnaire on our Facebook page, and the vast majority of families, parents and children who had experienced it were vaccinated. So just on a kind of, you know, not a scientific study, but just a, you know, questionnaire. Have you had it? Were you vaccinated or not? The vast majority were, in fact, vaccinated. So it just kind of speaks to the fact that there is clearly no guarantee of any kind that it'll, prevent one from contracting the disease.
You know, this whooping cough thing is very interesting to me. So I'm a generation older. My kids are in their 30s. And maybe, Carol, it's different with you, but I don't remember. None of my kids got whooping cough. I don't remember of hearing of a single child getting whooping cough.
Me either.
When my kids were in school. And now it is pretty, very, very common. And I'm just wondering if it isn't the vaccinations that have created this epidemic of whooping cough.
Yes, that's exactly what the guest blogger suggested. That, in fact, there might be something within. Because it's becoming very prevalent. I was shocked at the number of people who had reported that they'd experienced it. The whole families experienced it. It was horrible suffering.
Yeah, it's the worst. It is definitely the worst childhood illness. It takes a lot of patience and courage to get through it. And I'm just thinking, Carol, I'm going back to when I was a child. None of us got whooping cough, and I don't remember anyone ever getting whooping cough. So this whooping cough epidemic is new.
And you know, one of our, a woman, Ricky Juster, who is, had volunteered for Nourishing Our Children for a number of years, encountered, she works as a nanny and encountered family after family who wouldn't hire her because she hadn't had the vaccine. Mm-hmm. It is apparently now considered so essential. Every pediatrician is, recommending it to such a degree that parents are afraid of anyone coming into their family life without the vaccine.
And isn't that ironic? Isn't the vaccine supposed to protect you?
Right.
But it obviously doesn't. Yeah.
I was just going to mention the woman who wrote the blog post is Leslie Manoukian.
Oh, Manoukian. Yes. Yes.
Thank you. And she, yes. So she's the one who wrote, and the title of the blog post, is the pertussis vaccine causing the recent outbreaks?
Yeah.
Did I pronounce that correctly? Pertussis?
Pertussis.
Thank you. I knew that there was something off there. Yes.
Is pertussis the name for whooping cough? Is that
yes.
The, okay.
Yes.
Got it.
One of the things this book provides, as you know, is a whole sort of back end with traditional treatment or holistic treatments for childhood illnesses. And we do go into the treatment of whooping cough. Actually, I put it in two different places because I thought it was so important.
239, just for the listeners, page 239 is the whooping cough vaccine failure.
Lovely.
And page 238 is the summary for whooping cough. So in case anybody's got their book in front of them as they're listening, that's the reference.
One of my concerns, you know, one of my many concerns about vaccinations are just the toxic ingredients. I mean, thimerosal, you know, which is a preservative that contains mercury.
And, you know, you can get thimerosal-free vaccines. Mostly you can. They're more expensive, of course. But then they've upped the aluminum in these vaccines. So one theory which I mentioned in passing is that these children actually have many strokes from the vaccines.
Mm. Well, you know, the CDC recommends, what, 36 shots or something?
If your child is fully vaccinated, he will have 36 shots by the age of 5, and that starts on the first day, the day in the hospital. And I do have a section on, you know, what if you must vaccinate, what to do, and the first suggestion is wait till they're 2 for the first vaccination.
And then, but the vaccinations don't stop at age 5 or 6.
No, they keep on going.
They continue, and I think that the number was like in the 60s. You know,
we had this situation in World War One. The soldiers would write home and say, "I'm being vaccinated for baldness today. I'm being vaccinated for toe fungus today." They shot these soldiers with vaccinations, most of them experimental, every week practically, and this. At the time, it's not accepted as the reason, but at the time, people said that the great flu influenza epidemic was due to the destroyed immune systems from people getting so many vaccinations.
Wow. That, you know, that just doesn't surprise me at all. So the book goes on, and it really covers, you know, nourishing your growing child and one of the sections in here is the dangers of fluoride. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, well, fluoride is an enzyme inhibitor and a thyroid suppressant, and even our government warns now that children should not get too much fluoridated toothpaste. It can cause mottled teeth. So, yeah, Dr. Price didn't find any natives using fluoride, and they all had beautiful, healthy teeth. So, the key vitamin for healthy teeth is vitamin K. If you have adequate vitamin K in your saliva, you do not get cavities. And where do we get vitamin K? We get it from liver. We get it from cheese, egg yolks, the fats of grass-fed animals.
Huh. You know, it's interesting about cheese because I thought I had a dairy allergy.
Yes.
And so I cut out dairy, but now I eat raw cheese and I don't have a dairy allergy.
No, you had a pasteurization allergy.
Yeah. And so many people think they're allergic to dairy, and I agree. I think they're allergic to the pasteurization.
Yes.
And, you know, it's, you know, one more thing I wanted to say about fluoride, too. We have fluoride in our water in so many places, too, which is a problem.
Yeah, and, want non-fluoridated water, and I do talk about, you know, having good water in the book. So
right, and you know, for our listeners, if your city has fluoridated water, I think that, you know, we're all about empowering the people to take steps to make change, and, you know, get a group of people together and you know, go to your city, and if you find out you have fluoride in your water, you know, do a petition to get it out of the water.
It's but there's, very
there's many other reasons not to drink city water.
Yes.
It's not Florida.
Right. Well, that's one of the, you know, reasons too. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, I think many people, since bottled water, as we know, a lot of it is not very good, that they figure, what the heck, I'll just drink the tap water.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something that.
Well, you can get various kinds of purifiers, some of them which are expensive. So.
Right. You can get whole house purifiers and things like that.
You can get it under the kitchen sink.
Yeah.
Doulton one is very inexpensive. So.
Okay. And you have a chapter in here on child spacing and birth control.
Yes.
You know what? I have to tell you before Sally even starts that this topic is so controversial that I can hardly raise it without having sort of an avalanche of controversy descend upon us. People are very, I want to say sensitive to the notion that anyone would suggest to them when to conceive and how that timeline should progress.
Well, of course, people can do whatever they want, but both tradition and the science affirm that the ideal spacing is between children is at least 3 years, not only for the physical health of the baby and the mother, but also for the child's emotional development. And I quote from a number of government agencies who are urging, trying to help women space out their children in third world countries. We have the luxury in this country of being able to space our children. We have the knowledge to do it. And, I mean, people can do whatever they want, but I'm just presenting what the science says, and the ideal spacing is 3 years or more. Mm-hmm. It gives the mother a chance to recover, and I think that's extremely important. She has to be a healthy, robust mother for her family for many years, and I don't think her health should be put in jeopardy by having babies too close together.
Right. The argument that I've read, and I'm in agreement with you. I actually, it makes intuitive sense to me. And of course, Dr. Price documented it. Yeah. But the concern people raise is those who are putting their family planning into God's hands say that it's up to God, that they don't want to intervene in any way in God's plan for their family size.
Well, they're welcome to their opinion. I like to think of it as a partnership with God. Traditional people were very, very attuned to the spiritual world, and they certainly believed that it was entirely their responsibility not only to eat properly but to have spacing between the children. I mean, if you use that argument, you might as well say, doesn't matter how I eat either. It's just all up to God. And that's what a lot of people do say. When things go wrong, they just blame God.
No? Right.
Agree. Another subject I'd wanted to talk about, just because it was something I had to deal with, my son had ear infections one after the other. You know, he would wake up during the night and he would just be screaming and have a high fever and everything. So, he took a lot of antibiotics, and then we had the tubes in the ear. So do you have any thoughts on that, Sally or Sandrine?
I think there's quite a discussion about antibiotics for earaches. I mean, even conventional doctors are no longer routinely giving antibiotics. Our first thing with a child with earaches is get him off of pasteurized milk products. And I don't know what you were doing at that time, Carol.
Pasteurized milk products,
yeah, sure. Absolutely number one things. And then get them on raw milk if you can. Get them on the cod liver oil. But there is no question that consumption of pasteurized dairy is associated with frequent ear infections.
Mm-hmm. Do they still do tubes in the ears?
You know, yes, I think they do in very chronic cases, yes.
Hmm. Well, I just don't hear that much about it anymore. I mean, when my son is 32 years old now, and it was like all of his friends had tubes in their ears. It was just like every kid you met. And, it makes me wonder, knowing what I know now, I'm sure it was from, in part, by the pasteurized milk and very much diet related,
Right.
So
that's pretty well known now that if you're getting frequent ear infections, you need to get off pasteurized milk. Most doctors, I'm just talking about normal conventional doctors, know this and go ahead and give that advice.
Okay. And I don't know, the diseases that my kids had when they were young were the chicken pox and measles and mumps.
Yes.
And do we see as much of that, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, these diseases have been in decline for many years. long before vaccinations came along. Of course, we argue that the child should have these diseases, that they, each one of these childhood illnesses strengthens the immune system. And it's important for children to have fevers. And we just give, you know, normal, holistic treatments and continue the good diet. And usually these illnesses are very mild. But they're there for a reason. They strengthen different parts of the immune system. Mumps, for example, it's so much more important to have mumps, or so much better to have mumps when you're young than when you're a teenager or an adult.
Right, right.
Back to the ear infection, I just wanted to mention, Carol, as it turns out, we just posted on this topic this week, and one mother reported that she has great success with her breast milk. She squirts her breast milk right into her child's ear, and that clears it right up.
Wow, that's interesting, isn't
yes.
it?
Actually, I had a pediatrician read the whole manuscript, and that was one of her suggestions, too.
Was it really?
Wow. Yes.
That's amazing. Well, when my son was getting him, he was a little older and I wasn't breastfeeding. So we told our Facebook listeners that we're going to have both of you on the show. And we got this question, and I'm not sure if this is something you have advice for, but I said I'd do it. So I'm going to ask the question. This is from Audrey, and she said, I'd like to ask about how to balance living in a modern society where mom is generally home alone and has to cook and clean and do things so she can't give the baby 100% attention all the time, which her baby needs a lot of touching and interaction so much of the time. And then she puts dash, especially when baby hates the sling.
I just could not disagree more with this business of attachment parenting. It's a tremendous burden on the mother, and it's a burden on the child. The child does not want to be held all the time, doesn't need to be held all the time. And I do address this in the book. I talk about alternating the child from, first of all, being in a baby seat, sort of at a 45-degree angle so he can watch what's going on, watch you do your cleaning, watch you do your cooking. Then baby needs to be unfettered on the floor or in a playpen, kicking and learning to turn over and sit up and crawl and all those things. And finally held and nursed. But the baby, it's not good for baby or mother to be holding that baby all the time. Babies like to be alone just the way adults like to be alone.
Okay.
So I want to just, since you're wanting to re-enter the fold of this discussion, I posted on Facebook a banner that sort of had gone viral, as they say. It says, looking back, I realize I spent too much time holding my babies, period. Said no mom ever. And as I was mentioning a moment ago, you know, some 54,000 people saw the post. It was shared about 500 times, 700 people liked it. And I posed the question, what do you think? Can a baby possibly be held too much? And the resounding answer was no, never.
Well, I disagree.
So you're saying, yes, in fact, a baby can be held too much.
Yeah, the babies need to, they've got a lot of developing to do, and they need to do that on the floor on their own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my babies didn't want me to hold them. They were squirming and struggling to get out of my arms. If I'd sit down in a rocking chair with a baby, my daughter just climbed up, and she would have climbed over the rocking chair if I hadn't put her down over on the floor. But my experience is babies don't like to be held a lot. I don't think any mother should feel obligated because of this, you know, attachment parenting making her feel guilty. I don't think she should feel obligated to be holding her baby all the time. It's physically impossible anyway. If you believe that, then the only time you have to yourself and to do your work or your chores and do your cooking is when the baby's asleep.
Right. Well, this has been a wonderful hour, and I appreciate all this great information. And once again, the book is just absolutely wonderful, and it's called The Nourishing Traditions Book of Baby and Child Care. And Sally, they can get this anywhere online, Amazon,
Well, actually, there's probably going to be a temporary shortage. We've sold so many books. We've pretty much sold out online. They can get them from newtrendspublishing.com and probably from still can get them from bookstores, but there'll be a few weeks when they won't be able to get the book online. We are scrambling to reprint, but it takes a few weeks. Yeah.
Okay, and you want to both give us your websites before we sign off here?
Also, Carol, I just want to mention that the Nourishing Traditions book of baby and child care is the book that the Nutritional Wisdom Book Club is currently reading. And we have about 2,000 book club members on Facebook, the Nutritional Wisdom Book Club. Anyone on Facebook can put that in their search bar. And we are currently, we started the discussion this week. We're doing one chapter per week. And, we're anticipating a lot of interest and interaction already. People, you know, just in the introduction alone, we're having a lot of robust discussion. So if people are interested in reading along with us as part of a larger community, we will be checking in with Sally periodically with questions. And I think it's really quite fun for all of us to read together.
Huh. Okay. And do you want to give us your website, Sandrine?
Yeah.
And then we'll get Sally's and we'll let
sure.
you go.
We're nourishingourchildren.org. Nourishingourchildren.org.
Okay. And Sally, your website?
Well, it's newtrendspublishing.com. That's N-E-W-T-R-E-N-D-S publishing.com. And you can actually click on the book icon and read a couple of sample chapters. Also, the other website I recommend is westonaprice.org. And then if you're looking for raw milk, it's realmilk.com.
Okay. Well, thank you once again. This has been a great show, and I predict that this book is going to be the book.
We'll see. You either like it or you hate it. So.
Yeah. Well,
actually, there's a lot in between where people resonate with certain chapters or certain notions, and then some don't sit well. I think it's not so black and white. I think you know, some recommendations people really resonate with and others they're not so sure or they're opposed. I haven't heard anyone simply say, I don't like it or it's just a matter of maybe I don't like this recommendation.
Right. Yeah. Well, to me, it's never a one size fits all anyway. So, so thank you once again, all our listeners. And we hope you found this information helpful and we'll be back again next week with another great show. And as always, be well.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Sandrine.
Thank you, Sally and Carol. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.